DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I am delighted to be joined by Dr. David Pinault, who is a professor of religious studies and the director of the Arabic, Islamic, and Middle Eastern Studies program at Santa Clara University. His publications include Notes from the Fortune-Telling Parrot, Islam and the Struggle for Religious Pluralism in Pakistan, and The Shiites, Ritual and Popular Piety in a Muslim Community, as well as the novel Museum of Seraphs in Torment. With Dr. David Pinault, we go inside the pages of The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, A Christian's Companion for the Study of Islam, published by Ignatius Press. David, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Chris, and really it's an honor to be able to talk with you and with all of our listeners.
I wish I had you as a professor when I was at a Jesuit institution learning about Islam. What a fabulous book and approach that you take in instructing others about this religion.
Well, thank you.
Is that one of the reasons why you put the book together as you did?
Well, yes, actually, because of the fact that I feel that the book offers a perspective that's been lacking. And I guess specifically, I would say on the basis of my own reading and studying in Islam, that too often what happens in Christian-Muslim interfaith dialogue gatherings, that for the sake of fostering goodwill and so forth and other worthwhile things, both Christians and Muslims will minimize the radical differences between the two faiths. And I feel that that does a disservice to both Islam and Christianity. In fact, there are radical differences, and I think that we have to acknowledge those differences, frankly.
And the way that you present it, too, it's very comparative.
Yes.
So that way, the person who is coming from the Christian faith background, Catholic background in particular, is able to navigate through that lens. And it's very generous, actually, and it's filled with a great deal of charity, if you don't mind me saying that.
Oh, thank you. That's what I strive for. You see, all of this that I write in the book comes out of my personal experience as a Catholic Christian whose professional area is Islamic studies and who has the responsibility for teaching courses on Islam at a Catholic Christian university. And the challenge here is that what I have found increasingly is that on the one hand, many, if not most of my students come from a nominally Christian background. But the reality is that most of them are unchurched in the sense that they have only the vaguest notion of what Christianity is about. They badly need that remedial work, I feel, you know, in the background of their own faith. And yet here I am, my professional responsibility is teaching courses on Islam. So the way that I organize my courses, you know, I tell the students the very first day of the quarter that a great deal of the Quran, Islamic scripture, was intended in its composition to repudiate, to deny and refute basic truths of the Bible and of the Jewish and Christian faiths. And so what I tell them is, there's no way that you're going to understand what the Quran is doing unless you have some sense of the Bible, which means then that in the classes that I teach on Islam, I have the students read the Quran and the Bible in tandem, read it together so that they can, yes, learn about Islam, but also become reacquainted with Christianity from this fresh comparative perspective.
I think that is a fantastic way of approaching it, because when I took courses on Islam when I was in college, it was presented as something completely separate. I had to do all that synthesizing in my own brain. There was an attempt to absolutely keep them separate.
Yeah.
It made it very sterile.
Yes. You see, and in fact, you know, the way that I present Islam to my students is, first of all, of course, it's worth knowing about, you know, in its own right. Mm-hmm. And anyone who picks up a newspaper today can see that. So that I, you know, when I first started studying in the field of Islamic and Arabic studies back in 75, I would have people say to me, oh, Arabic, Islam, interesting, but obscure. What are you going to do with that? Now, today, people don't say that, right? No. So there's a practical dimension to it. But what's more important to me, actually, coming from my own faith background as a Catholic Christian, is that, you know, what I want students to get a sense of is the fact that studying Islam can help us Christians rediscover the unique truths of our own Catholic Christian faith, because precisely because of the fact that Islam lays claim to familiar figures that are central to Christianity, but interprets those figures in ways that are radically different.
Yeah, I don't think today we even appreciate the fact that this, the Islamic religion came forward 6 centuries after the establishment of Christianity. And actually, that's quite a gap.
Oh, it's an enormous gap. Yes, it's very, very significant. And it's interesting to see how, again, Islam reinterprets the Abrahamic and Judeo-Christian tradition in ways that are very, very significant. And I would say that one of the things that I try to convey to the students is how important it is to grasp what those differences are, so that on the one hand, Islam does honor Jesus Christ. It claims that Jesus is a prophet. It claims that Jesus was a Muslim. But in the Quran, it also puts words into the mouth of Christ in which Christ is made to condemn basic doctrines of the Christian faith. So what this means then is that Islam denies the reality of the Trinity. Islam denies that Jesus was the Son of God. Islam denies that Jesus was divine. It denies that he was ever crucified on the cross. It denies that he ever rose from the dead. And this is very important also, that nowhere in the Quran does it ever mention Jesus Christ in relation to suffering. And so, in other words, what is done away with are what I regard as, you know, basic truths of the Christian faith.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that was such a bell ringer for me as I was entering into your book, was that, quite honestly, the telling of the story, the development of the faith of the Prophet Muhammad, it's not in isolation of its own experience. But you have to understand the world in which he was born and its relationship to what's going on in Christendom. So by doing that, all of a sudden you're having these aha moments, and it wasn't something that was done in isolation.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because one of the things that I try to do is to, you know, to trace the history of Islamic belief and, you know, to do that in some detail. And so what I do in the book is, first of all, to look at the faith tradition that Muhammad himself grew up in the 6th century AD in Arabia. You know, some people have the mistaken notion that Muhammad must have grown up as a Muslim, but no. In fact, you know, he was a member of a pagan polytheistic religious tradition that is referred to as the Jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah is an Arabic word. It comes from the Quran, and the Quran itself simply picks up on a cultural term that had existed for centuries, you could say. But the term Jahiliyyah, you know, literally means the time or the age of ignorance, or things pertaining to ignorance, meaning ignorance of Islam. Mm-hmm. And it's the term that's used today by English-speaking Muslims to refer to the pagan Arab society, its religious values, its cultural practices, etc. And it's a society in which people did believe in gods and in various types of nature spirits known as jinns. Mm-hmm. We sometimes call them genies. And these jinns, you know, thickly cohabit the earth all around us. And, you know, so atheism was not an option in the Jahiliya pagan Arabia Muhammad grew up in. The operative question, and this is something that I often say to my students, the operative question was not whether to believe in God or not. In fact, I would say that we humans have been religious for as far back as history and prehistory, archaeology can trace us. The operative question has not been whether to believe in God. That tends to be taken for granted. But the big question for humans has always been, does God care about us, or is God simply indifferent? And the Jahiliya Arab answer was, those gods exist, those deities exist, but they cannot be counted on to care for us. They're capricious, they're willful, you can never predict their behavior. And what happened was that Muhammad grew up in a very tribal environment in which one tribe is pitted against another. And that means that there's a sense of, just as there's a scattering of gods throughout the landscape, there's also a scattering of rival tribes, each at each other's throat competitively. Now, Muhammad, as a young man, was a traveling businessman in merchant caravans. And the earliest Muslim biographies themselves admit that in his business travels, which took him throughout the peninsula up into southern Jordan, as far north as Syria, in his travels, he came upon, had contact with both Jews and Christians. Not only that, the earliest Islamic biographies emphasize that when he would encounter Jews and Christians, Muhammad was consistently curious about their faith and would ask them about their religion, and apparently they would also read aloud to him from their scriptures, recite to him from their scriptures. It impressed Muhammad tremendously. And what Muhammad did was to select out, combine elements of the Jewish and Christian tradition, especially the notion of strict monotheism, and combine that with elements of his own Jahiliya pagan Arab background.
For you to have this greater understanding and presentation, it wasn't that you just learned this studying at a California university.
Yeah.
You were immersed in the culture, weren't you?
Well, that's true, yes. In other words, when I first started work in this field, I was doing field work in North Africa, Northwest Africa, the Middle East. And then in the course of the late 80s, I became very interested in the Shia tradition. People who are listening may know that there are two major denominations in Islam, the Sunni and the Shia. And I became interested in learning more about the Shia tradition. I wasn't able at that time to get a research visa for Iran, so I wound up doing work with Shia Muslim communities in Pakistan and India. And then more recently, I've become intrigued by Southeast Asia. So I've spent a considerable amount of time in countries such as Indonesia and Malaysia. And throughout that time, what's interesting is that while I was working on various research projects, I also made contact with local Christian minority populations. Because throughout the Islamic world, as you may know, there are small pockets of faithful Christian communities, many of whom experience really brutal persecution at the hands of the Muslim majority. So I've had the privilege of working with Christian minority populations, especially in Yemen, Pakistan, Indonesia, and Egypt. And as I discuss in my book, as you know, I spend quite a bit of time writing about this in the book, the experience of seeing Christians hold on to their faith and give witness really fearlessly to their faith identity as Christians in these Islamic settings, that has had the experience of really strengthening my own faith as a Catholic and my own sense of identity as a Christian. And in fact, that's what inspired the title of the book.
Yeah, it is an absolutely phenomenal book. Again, we're talking with Dr. David Pinault about his book, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, A Christian's Companion for the Study of Islam. And there is so much in this book, David. It is so rich that I want to dive into each chapter. But I think one of the important ones for me that really it touched me in many ways was the section on the crucifixion. And as you titled, The Enigma of Christ's Crucifixion in the Quran. Because Christ and that moment on the cross and his subsequent resurrection, that is so central to the to Christian understanding of who we are. Because if that hadn't happened, then what's the point of our Christian faith? And your entrance into that, understanding that, especially from the Islamic perspective, I thought was a real eye-opener.
Yes, you see, and this is worth explaining. As I mentioned earlier, Islam denies the reality of Christ's crucifixion. Islam states that Jesus was not truly crucified on the cross. And the reason for that, I think, in my own studies, is that the Prophet Muhammad, on the one hand, he identified intensely with various figures from the Abrahamic tradition whom Muhammad regarded as prophets of Islam. So the Quran talks about figures ranging from Noah and Abraham through to Moses and Jesus Christ. Each of them Muhammad visualizes as a prophet of Islam who is rejected and persecuted, but ultimately triumphs through the will of Allah. And but in each case, the Quran emphasizes, and in fact, the Quran states explicitly that Allah will cause his prophets to triumph, and that Allah will deliver the believers and his prophets in this life as well as in the next life. Mm-hmm. And so Muhammad rejected the notion that Christ could have been killed, because from the point of view of Islam, the notion of Christ being crucified would mean humiliation and defeat for God's prophets and a kind of dishonoring, whereas Muhammad firmly believed in the notion of triumph both in the next life and in this life. You have to keep in mind that, you know, Muhammad was, from the point of view of Islam, not just a prophet, but also a military leader, mm-hmm. as well as a, you know, civic leader like a mayor. And so Muhammad was triumphant politically and militarily. And so he could not tolerate the notion of Jesus being humiliated and apparently defeated. And so, in fact, the Quran in chapter 5 actually prescribes crucifixion as one of the suitable punishments for those who cause mischief in the land or wage war against Allah. So you can see why, from Muhammad's perspective, what I would call a very this worldly perspective, especially for someone like him who is very touchy about his you know, personal honor and reputation, you can see why he would reject the notion of the crucifixion. But of course, as I point out in the book, I mean, one of the major reasons why I wrote this book, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, is to bring out how when you study Islam as a Christian, what comes out in very stark relief are the central truths of Christianity. Because for me, as a Christian, the fact that I have to go through suffering and anguish in my own life is something that I can endure in large part because of the fact that I know that Christ has been a pioneer in suffering before me. Because as Christians, what we believe is that God loves us, God loves this world so much that he gives us his Son, God made man, who becomes flesh and who empties himself canonically, and I talk about this in the book as well. He empties himself, he makes himself vulnerable so that he is able to enter fully into our human condition of suffering. And the God that we worship is a God who voluntarily undertakes suffering in solidarity with all created beings.
We'll return to Inside the Pages in just a moment. Did you know that you can obtain a free app which contains all your favorite Discerning Hearts programs? Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Archbishop George Lucas, Father Maurizio Sfildi, and so many more, including episodes from Inside the Pages, can be obtained on the Discerning Hearts free app. This also includes all the novenas and devotionals and prayers, including the Holy Rosary and Stations of the Cross, the Chaplet of St. Michael, and the Seven Sorrows of Our Lady, all available on the Discerning Hearts free app. Visit the iTunes and Google Play app stores to obtain your free Discerning Hearts app today.
Soul of Christ, sanctify me. Body of Christ, save me. Blood of Christ, inebriate me. Water from the side of Christ, wash me. Passion of Christ, strengthen me. O good Jesus, hear me. Within thy wounds, hide me. Suffer me not to be separated from thee. From the malignant enemy, defend me. In the hour of my death, call me, and bid me come to thee, that with thy saints I may praise thee, forever and ever. Amen.
If you have been blessed in some way by the spiritual nourishment and teachings offered freely by all those involved with Discerning Hearts programs, please consider a positive review for the various programs on the iTunes and Google Play stores. This is a great way to help the ministry and is an encouragement to others who are seeking the best in spiritual formation to find and check out the programs. Won't you please help? It's an easy way to help give back and to be a part of the mission. Thank you, and God bless from all at Discerning Hearts.
We now return to Inside the Pages. This is why I think your book, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, A Christian's Companion for the Study of Islam, is so important. Because I have read many books on Islam. I have talked to a lot of people who will compare between this is what we believe, this is what they believe. But I've never read anything that helps us to understand them and then subsequently ourselves better, like I have through this work. I think this is an extraordinary, I think it's an extraordinary contribution to what can truly be an interfaith dialogue. Because there have been problems with that in the past, hasn't there?
Oh, yes, it certainly has. And I talk about this in the book because I've seen this again and again. You know, sometimes when I've shown up for Christian-Muslim dialogue gatherings and sometimes in the things that I've read. And a large part, I think, of what happens is, again, you know, many well-meaning Christians prioritize goodwill. That is, of course, very understandably, they want to make sure that people are not prejudiced and bigoted and so forth. And so they emphasize what Islam and Christianity have in common. And of course, there are certain things that, you know, Christianity and Islam do have in common. But so often what I've seen happen is that people will, as I said earlier, they will minimize the differences between the two faiths. And as I said, that really does a disservice to both, because you wind up not really understanding what are the bedrock beliefs of Islam, and you're left without a sense of what constitutes the unique truths of our Catholic Christian faith. And that's something that I think we cannot afford to discard, especially now when you know, so many people are really not well educated in the basics of Catholic Christianity.
I think, too, David, one of the most fascinating chapters, the one I had to go back and I had to read it a couple times or just slow down so I could absorb what was being taught in its pages, was the chapter on Jesus in the ascetic and the Sufi mystical traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, examining the depth of prayer from those perspectives, that was something completely different for me.
Yes. In fact, what I did in those chapters was to investigate what you could call the mystical dimension of religion. And one of the things that I've spent time over the years doing is working directly with those Muslims that are known as Sufis. And Sufism is simply the mystical dimension of Islam. And when I talk about mysticism, what I mean is that aspect of religion that has to do with an individual person's direct, immediate, and personal experience of God in this life without having to wait for the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I do in the book is to look at how Sufi Muslims related to Jesus. And you see, this is something that's very, very interesting. There has always been an ascetic dimension in Islam, as there has in other religions as well. And by asceticism, I mean basically a life, a way of life in which the individual person turns away radically from the things of this world so as to orient themselves more towards the next life. And the interesting thing is that Sufism and the ascetic tradition in Islam, they grew up, I think, as a reaction against Islam's worldly success, because Muhammad himself, of course, led jihad, or, you know, religious warfare campaigns against unbelievers. And the caliphs, Muhammad's political successors as leaders of the Ummah, the emerging Islamic caliphate, they launched war against the Byzantine Christian Empire, against the Sassanid Persians, and so forth. And so very, very rapidly, within the space of a generation or two, Islam began to become a political world empire. Slavery, as you know, is permitted in Islam, and so thousands upon thousands of slaves were flooding into the Islamic Caliphate. And of course, that model has influenced ISIS, the Islamic State, to this day. In any case, what you have going on is a flood of material prosperity and in Islam very early on. And the Sufis were among those people who turned against this. And now the interesting thing is, who do Sufis look to as their model? And one of the things that I explore in my book is the fact, a very, very interesting point of sort of cross-religious contact. Every Muslim, of course, is obligated to imitate the lifestyle of the Prophet Muhammad. But for those Muslims who are ascetic, who were mystically minded, they faced a certain challenge, because Muhammad, of course, yes, he's a religious leader, but he was also a military warlord and very much caught up in things of this world. Muhammad accumulated a total of 13 wives. And for those Muslims who are ascetically minded, what's interesting is that they became fascinated by the figure of Jesus Christ. And what's even more intriguing is that, and this is something I trace in the book, many aspects of Jesus that are referred to in Sufi Muslim devotional literature in the Middle Ages, many aspects of Christ are actually references to Christ that do not appear in the Quran. In other words, there were folk tales about Jesus in the Middle Ages that circulated in medieval Christian Arabic literature. And there were various references to Jesus in the Bible that became known to these mystically minded ascetic Sufi Muslims. The image of Jesus that appears in the medieval Sufi Islamic literature is Jesus as a wanderer, somebody who engaged voluntarily in poverty and who never slept under a roof but would sleep outdoors. And Jesus became a compelling model for many Sufi Muslims in past centuries, someone who essentially was unmarried, someone who never had any physical possessions, someone who always had his face turned towards God. And so for me as a Christian, it was interesting to see these reflections, so to speak. The Sufi Muslims, from my perspective as a Christian, the Sufi Muslims still miss out on certain essential basics, you know, the crucifixion and Christ's sufferings on the cross, the fact that he's Son of God. But nonetheless, the Sufis do focus on something that, to me, involves reflections of Jesus, especially, as I said, you know, the passages that suggest how, you know, the foxes have their burrows and the birds of the air have their home, have their nest, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Those kinds of passages that we recognize from the Christian Gospels, that does not appear in the Quran, but it made its way through through the Christian Arab folklore tradition, and the Sufis became fascinated with that. So it's interesting to see that as a kind of sort of a spiritual meeting point, if you like, between the two faiths.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that's so compelling in reading this is the appreciation of the different aspects, as it were, or expressions of the Islamic religion. I suppose those who are looking at the Christian religion could in some ways say something similar in the fact that we see as Catholics how we feel we have the full communion with Christ in the expression of our faith. But then our Protestant brothers and sisters take certain aspects of that and make that their own. The same is done in Islam. I don't want to try to over make it too simplistic, but there is that kind of a splintering, too harsh of a word, or is it just a expression of the faith? There are differences.
Oh yes, and the differences are radical. The thing that is very poignant is to see that Jesus Christ has been, throughout the centuries, such a compellingly attractive figure that people of many, many different faith backgrounds, and this is not limited to, you know, Christianity and Islam, people of many different faith backgrounds have felt drawn to him, so that you know, in living in India, I would, for example, encounter, you know, Hindus and Buddhists who would speak with great admiration and fondness of Jesus Christ, you know? So, I mean, that's something that sort of, if you like, draws us together as humans.
You know, I think, too, for many of us, our understanding of what Islam is because of the fact that, you know, in the United States, we have this thing called the separation of church and state. So that for many of us, we have our religion, but then our political identity, though that can be schizophrenic for some, you know, and how we live it out. But there is this divide. But in Islamic cultures, correct me if I'm wrong, David, but there is no dividing line. So a political expression and the religious expression can become something it's difficult for us to delineate.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. And of course, you see, what has happened in Islamic societies over the last 50 years or so has been really remarkable. In other words, up through about 1970 or so, many specialists in Middle Eastern studies thought that secularism would be the wave of the future in the Islamic Middle East. And in fact, it's true that many political movements in Muslim societies reacting to, say, Western colonialism and things like that, they experimented with things like, you know, Marxism, for example, socialism. The you know, people forget that in countries like Iraq and Iran, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, you know, countries, Muslim countries like that had active communist parties, you know, and then what happened was that you can really see the transformation in 1979 with Khomeini's Islamic revolution and the hostage crisis that we Americans remember, that with all of that, essentially what happened is that Muslims in many, many parts of the world seized on what I would call political Islam, essentially as a way of saying no to aspects of modernity and saying no to the Western world, so that Christianity becomes associated in people's minds with the West, and many Muslims throughout the Islamic world seize on Islam as a way of repudiating various aspects of the outside world. And I think that explains why, again and again, what you have in so many Muslim societies today is a very strong emphasis on what I would call the outward forms of the faith. Hence this notion of legislating the idea that women in countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia and so forth are required to wear what they call modest dress, the hijab, the headscarves, and sometimes facial coverings, etc., and why groups like the Taliban and ISIS and so forth insist that men must wear regulation beards in imitation of the Prophet Muhammad. And that sheds light, too, on what has happened in Pakistan now in the case of the Pakistani Christian woman, Asia Bibi. Many listeners may be aware of the fact that she is a Pakistani Christian who was accused of blasphemy by her Muslim neighbors in a quarrel. She wound up on death row for years, and only just now has the upper court in Pakistan allowed her to be released. Although as of this moment, the latest I heard is it's still unclear where she is going to be able to live, because it's very, very, very dangerous to her if she has to stay in Pakistan. And I mentioned the case of Asia Bibi, and I talk about her in the book, in the Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch. I mention this because of the fact that the thing that astonished me when I lived and worked in Pakistan, in all my visits there, I was astonished to find out how very popular the blasphemy law is. I'll just explain that according to this ordinance, under the terms of it, anyone who dishonors or, questions the Quran Anyone who dishonors the Quran anyway, that's mandatory life imprisonment. And anyone who dishonors or questions Muhammad and his reputation in any way, that's mandatory death penalty. And I was just so taken aback when I saw that not only are those laws on the books, but they're very popular. And the reason why the blasphemy law is so popular is because of the fact that this is seen as a way of protecting the collective identity of Muslims throughout Pakistan. And I think that that's something to keep in mind when you are asking about how difficult it is to distinguish religion and state in Islam, that so often what happens in that kind of circumstance is that the focus becomes less on one's personal devotion and individual relationship with God, and instead the focus becomes the outward expression of collective identity. And there is, I think, a tremendous danger, a risk to that if one is not careful.
So as someone who, as that young man back in 1975, before the world events made your course of study even more relevant and wow, you know, that this is the path you would be on. And as someone who has lived in these countries, what would your advice be to really the Christian community as a whole on how to proceed forward, not only in our own country, in our dealings with our Islamic brothers and sisters, quite honestly, fellow citizens, but also in our engagement with those in their countries?
Well, I think that in terms of relations, I would say a couple of things. First of all, that if we're talking about religion with our Muslim neighbors, I think what we do is we give witness to what we value and what we believe in. If we are having conversations about the faith, of course, you know, we're there to listen, to learn to what's most important to Muslims from their perspective, and at the same time, to speak frankly about what is distinctive and uniquely precious, you know, to us as Christians in our own faith. And then aside from that, I would say that in looking both domestically and internationally, that obviously when it comes to matters of doctrine in the faith, these are areas where we disagree radically. But it is possible to come together on projects. For example, in the book, I mentioned the fact that in Indonesia, I had the privilege of meeting a Muslim animal rights activist who had established a wildlife rescue organization for animals being trafficked illegally from places like Southeast Asia up into communist China. Mm-hmm. And he wound up inviting me to serve as a volunteer with his group because he was very eager to have this interfaith dimension to the volunteer service. And, you know, frankly, I'm too old to be living in the jungle, but they took very good care of me, and it was a fantastic experience. And, in fact, I've continued to do this work as a volunteer with wildlife in Southeast Asia.
So, yeah, there are ways of coming together, but part of it is understanding each other. And yeah. I think one of the things that you've done in your book that's so beautiful is not only do we understand them, that we begin to understand ourselves, too, in a different way. I mean, what you've done is you've given us an opportunity to look at this multifaceted diamond that's our faith and given us a new vantage point.
Yes.
But we still are looking at the whole, but it gives us a different a glean, I think, if that's fair.
Yes, and I think, Chris, that your image is a wonderful one, you know, that, you know, think of our faith as a diamond, as a precious stone, and, you know, you turn it in the light, and different facets reflect aspects of the light, and, you know, the truths of the Christian faith are inexhaustible, and, you know, studying it from different perspectives, including the comparative one that I offer in the Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, I hope will bring out aspects of our faith that perhaps otherwise we might not notice or perhaps just take for granted.
I love it. I couldn't put it down. I broke the spine and everything. Shame on me, but I couldn't help it.
Yeah.
I was falling asleep reading it. It was so good. But David, I wish we had more time. Any final thoughts?
Well, I would say if there's one final thought I'll leave you with, it's that, you know, people often ask me, what's the greatest international challenge facing people of faith today, and especially facing us American Christians? And I would say that internally in our own culture, the greatest challenge is our secular culture of materialism and infinite distractibility, courtesy of our smartphones. But internationally, I would say that our greatest challenge is not militant Islam. Militant Islam, it strikes me as a short-range threat. The longer-range threat, I would say, is the Chinese Communist Party under President Xi Jinping. Because if you've been keeping up with what's going on in China today, the Chinese Communist Party has renewed the Maoist practice, the practice going back to Mao Zedong, of persecuting people of faith. That includes spiritual movements like the Falun Gong. That includes the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang province. And it includes Christians throughout the whole country of China, persecuting them for their faith, demolishing churches and crosses where they appear in public. And it seems to me that it's high time for us Christians in America, to rediscover our faith, and especially this notion of a God-made man who suffers in solidarity with us. We need to rediscover those strengths because we have a long struggle ahead of us, and we need to strengthen ourselves and our faith to be up to that.
Boy, did you just make a major clarion call. I agree with you 100%, and I have a feeling we could have a whole nother conversation about that particular aspect and how the Christian and i.e. Catholic Church has responded to that. We got to be very careful right now.
Yes, absolutely. And as you say, that's a topic for another time, but I'd be very happy to explore that with you perhaps in a future broadcast.
Well, I look forward to that. David Punnell, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Chris. It's been an honor.
With Dr. David Punnell, we've gone inside the pages of The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, A Christian's Companion for the Study of Islam. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Ignatius.com, the website for its publisher, Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this conversation, along with hundreds of other spiritual formation programs, visit discerninghearts.com. Or you can find them on the free Discerning Hearts app, available at the Apple App or Google Play app stores. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We hope that if this has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission. And if you feel us worthy, consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax deductible, to help support our efforts. But most of all, we hope that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for Inside the Pages, Insights from Today's Most Compelling Authors.